Live with Rudy Sarzo. Hi, Rudy. It's lovely to see you again.
You too, Vicky. How you doing?
I'm doing good. It's been like 7 years, and the last time we saw each
Yes,
other, the
yeah.
world was different, wasn't it?
It's a whole different world, and we're different humans from it too. Yeah.
How we started to talk about this before we came live, and we decided to hold it for the show. So how did COVID impact you, Rudy?
Well, when COVID, when I felt the impact of it, when it really affected me, I was touring with the Guess Who, and we were doing a residency at the Epcot Center in Orlando. And
That
it's
was
it
right in
I
the middle of it, like when they shut things
it
down.
was like 20 oh no, two,
Was
was it 2000?
2020. It was March 2020 when they shut everything
We,
down,
when
right?
the lockdown happened,
Right.
we were like, it was like March 16 or something like that, like when they said, okay, officially we're on lockdown, right? So it happened like overnight. Like, oh yeah, this is coming down. There's a lockdown, right? And there's a park. We're staying at the lagoon. They have our hotel. We could see the people diminishing in amount of people by the last day of the residency, because what happened is we were supposed to play for 4 nights, but we wound up playing all the way through. We were the last attraction open. I got photos of the first show we did. It was packed, every seat in the house. The last show, there was like four or five cast members of from Epcot sitting in the audience because everybody was gone.
Oh my God.
But they wanted to keep it open, keep us there. So we barely got out of Orlando the following day. So I look and I say, you know what? People keep saying, oh, it's probably gonna last a few weeks. No, this is pretty serious. So right there and then, I made a decision. Like, you know what? This is probably going to go down for a while. I don't know when, but I'm going to take the opportunity to improve myself in my own field as a musician and as a human being. So I went in search of the healing qualities of music, sound, the healing qualities of sound.
So,
Whether, yeah.
explain to me what that means to you.
Oh, well, what it means is that I have experience being on stage with different artists, different bands, from Ozzy Osbourne to the Guess Who. And I see the effect of that music has on the audience and ourselves when we play, but mainly the audience, because we as musicians, we're creating the sound waves. And I say waves because my research took me all the way down to quantum physics,
Wow.
because that is what frequencies, that's the foundation of frequencies. You have waves and particles. That's the foundation of quantum physics,
Were you a smarty pants in school? Did you study this stuff when you were a student?
I was a dreamer. I wasn't a fancy, I wasn't really into the academic program that they were offering because I was bored.
Because you
It's
are a
not that
smarty pants.
it's not that I knew what they were talking about. It's just that I wanted something deeper. And it was very back in, I'm 73, so we're talking about education system, and I went to up to fifth grade in Cuba, and then my mom said, "Well, you're in a different country with different language, so we're going to put you back in the fifth grade." So I did the fifth grade twice, once in Spanish and one in English, and I was very, I had a lot of questions, but I couldn't ask them because I did not have the command of the language. I'm still a work in progress as far as English goes for me,
Did you
even
how did
though.
you learn English, Rudy? Did you learn while you were in Cuba? Did you learn when you came to
No.
Miami? How'd you learn?
Yeah, I learned in school, and I had experiences where, kids, we go through embarrassing moments in our lives, and it's just a matter of like, okay, I will never forget this, but you move on, So one of them was that the teacher, who should have known better because he knew I did not have I couldn't speak. So he asked me to read from the book, stand up and read. Back in those days, you stand up and you read to the class. So I looked at it and I went, oh, it's the same letters as in Spanish. So I'm going to read it. I'm going to read it phonetically. And it sounded like, you know, it sounded like a joke, basically. And the kids started laughing.
Were you scared? Did that instill fear or intimidation in you?
That's an interesting question. No, I was in survival mode. So when you're in survival mode, I've never been scared. I need to get things done. It's like, you know, what is it? Fight or flight. One of the
Interesting.
Two.
Interesting.
And rarely in a situation like that, you can't run away from it.
You're right there. You're in the moment. Yeah. You got to be there. You got to deal.
Yeah. You're contained in this classroom and you're like in all eyes on you. And how am I going to handle that? With no command of the language. So I started to develop a lot of body language. So
did you watch TV at home to help you with the language?
In the United States? Yeah, that was my baby. But, you know, I mean, I was 10. When I got to the United States, I was almost 11. I was about 3 or 4 months shy of turning 11 years old. But still, you know, my parents had to go to work and stuff like that. So the TV was always on to entertain me and my brother, who's 4 years younger than me. So he was more of a child than I was. I was almost a preteen. And when you are going through that experience, you start growing up really fast. I did, you know, because I had to, again, survival mode. I got to adapt and embrace a new identity. Even my name changed.
Really?
Yeah, my name. My.
You
my
have
name
a
is,
really long. What's your full name?
My birth name or my birth certificate is Rodolfo Maximiliano Salzo La Vieja Grande Ruiz Parejo Mon. Okay, which is. And I did the ancestry.com thing. And so I'm like 29% Spanish from Spain. You know, they give it to you by countries, you know,
right.
not by culture,
right.
You know. So it's Spain. Then the other one is Basque, which is very rare. There's not a whole lot of Basque that I'm 23% Basque, which is also a part of Spain.
But it's a very tiny part, right?
Well, it sits in the Pyrenees. So it's in between Spain and France. So then I have like 16% French and then about 14 Portuguese. So basically, and then I got Irish. I have Scottish. I don't know where that came from. And then the Italian, 2%. And then as far as African, it amounts to 6%. And of course, if you come from Spain, because the Moors had conquered Spain for almost a century and a half, or maybe even two centuries. And so there's a lot of, especially in the south of Spain, a lot of Moorish, which is Northern African bloodline in there. Yeah.
So you're 10, 11, whatever, and you're here and you're in America and you're just learning the language.
Yeah.
Are you failing at school? Are you passed? Are you able to do your classes? Are you able to do it?
That's a really good question. I remember getting C's a lot of C's. I was never a, you know, because I had difficulty.
Yeah,
you know?
That's pretty good getting C's.
I did not fail, but I was average because of my lack of the command of the English language. So my family was relocated from Miami to New Jersey a couple of years after we landed. We landed in Miami in 1961. By 63, right before the, I was in Miami during the missile crisis.
That was an intense place to be when that was
going
on.
I mean, I watched the troops marching down Flagler Street, which is like the main street. Oh, yeah. But see, but to them, that meant that maybe there's a resolve. Maybe the regime's going to fall because the United States is going to do something about it.
Right.
I was in Cuba during the Bay of Pigs.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's and that failed. I mean, we can go into details, but you know, it's pretty complex. So anyways, by 63, because there was
I want to hear all of this. Did your parents have a hard time getting you all out of Cuba?
It took us about a year and a half.
How did you get out?
They got, first you have to have a sponsor claim you from the United States. So in order to get the visa, of course, before that, you got to have the passport to attach the visa to it. You got to get the tickets. And so it was a process, took about a year and a half. Also, we were going to be on a cruise. And the plan, you know, like a ship that was going to leave Havana and go to New York. And the plan was to get off the ship and ask for political asylum.
Wow.
But the cruise before the one we were going to take, they did that. Like just about the whole ship got off.
Right.
And asked for political asylum. So the company who ran the cruise said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go straight rather than to New York. We're going to go straight from Havana to Spain. My parents did not. They wanted to go to the United States because of the friendliness that the United States, and, you know, there was a lot of ties between Cuba and the United States before the revolution.
Right.
You know? And my parents saw that as the best place to take my brother and me, you know. And they always thought, well, this is not going to last too long.
What did your father do in Cuba, Rudy?
There was this, I'm talking about 1950s, early 60s technology. Mm-hmm. Back then, magazines where they had like huge machine that would print out newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. And he ran that machine for a magazine called Bohemia, La Bohemia, the Bohemian. And it was, there were only about Bohemia, Vanidades y Cartel. There were like three major magazines in the country. And he ran the machine, the printing, it's a huge printing machine. Mm-hmm. You've probably seen them in the movies when like back in black and white, they have these.
Yeah,
like
sure.
Big, huge bobbins, you know. Yes, that's what he ran. And so he was a technician. So they were not allowing technicians who had knowledge and, you know, they were trained to run things. They were not allowing them to leave the country. So my dad had pretty much had to be under the radar, traveling with my brother and me and my mom, of course. Yeah. So going back to my name, so we got relocated to New Jersey, and my first day in school, West New York, public school number 5. They assigned me a seat. Well, by the time I got there, the school year had started. So there was an empty seat in the back, and they said, yeah, you can take that one. And so I'm like opening up, you know, the old fashioned desk.
Oh, yeah.
You have the lid with the books inside. And so I'm like checking things out. And I hear the name Rudy, 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 Rudy. I'm like, I'm not paying attention. I'm Rudolph. By then, I had gone from Rodolfo to Rudolph. So in Miami, it was Rudolph. So I happened, you know, I put the lid down, I look at the teacher, and he goes, yes, you, Rudy. And I go, oh, no, me, Rudolph. And he says, no, you're Rudy from now on.
Wow.
And, you know, you're trying to adapt. So I say, okay, that's fine. I'm Rudy. Okay, that sounds good. Never heard that before.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I imagine it took a little time to get comfortable in this new language and this new country. So you got here in the early 60s, right?
Yeah.
63? 61. So were you, did you play an instrument at that point?
I'm sorry.
Were you playing music at then?
No, but I love music. Music has always been in a form of release and entertainment. It makes me dream more just to listen to the music. It's like the perfect soundtrack for whatever daydreaming you're happen to be doing, you know, if you listen to music. Even if you had, if I, I didn't understand the lyrics, I could hear the emotion of the notes and the way that the singers sang, you know. And I mean, I, you know, when I listen to certain singers, I still don't understand what they're saying because they enunciate
the
lyrics.
Neither do I.
Yeah, you know, lyrics are, can be pretty hard to understand.
Yes.
You know, so you know, after 60 years, I still have trouble listening, going, what is he singing or she's singing?
Especially Mick Jagger. I half the time,
yes,
I have no idea what he's saying.
First one that comes to mind. Yeah, Mick Jagger. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as music goes, you know, it's really interesting as far as adapting and being on that survival mode. Okay, this was the big turning point for my generation. So it's 1963. I had just arrived in New Jersey, and mm-hmm. it's November, and I'm in school, and the teacher comes in and says, President Kennedy just got shot. Right? And I'm like, this is my last hope. This is the guy who I thought was going to do it. You know, my hero,
wow.
You know, Kennedy is the only one that could stand up to Castro and Khrushchev and tell him to go to hell, you know.
Wow.
And he's dead. It's like, okay, so now, you know, Thanksgiving is gloom and doom, not just in our household, but the whole
country, absolutely.
The whole world, actually. But we were not getting a whole lot of news, global news. It was mostly like the Huntley Brinkley report and, you know, all
right.
stuff like that. You know, two or three news, you know, newscasters back then, major ones. You know, there was only CBS, mm-hmm. NBC, and ABC.
Right.
That was it, you know. And so we have a gloom and doom for Thanksgiving, and then Christmas, same thing. New Year's Eve, same thing. And it was like, you know, by January, February, you know, my generation, kids were going, wow, we got to get out of this funk, you know. And then the Beatles happened. That changed everything completely overnight. Boom.
I love the way you tied those two things together, because I had never put those two things together until I heard you say that. And it's fascinating because I was a little younger than you, but I remember those two things vividly, but I never would have tied them together like that.
Yeah. Were you in the New York area at the time?
Yeah, I was in New York, and I was in school when they sent us home when Kennedy was shot. And, you know, my mom was home crying, and we went through all of that. And then I was sitting in front of the TV when the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, like everybody else.
Yeah. What I experienced, because at that time in West New York, there were not a whole lot of Latinos that were more like in New York and the Bronx and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, my family was one of the first ones to come over to be relocated from Miami to New Jersey. So I really didn't have, my family didn't have a whole lot of friends.
Why did you guys go to New Jersey? Did you have a small family contingent there?
Oh, no. We were alone up there.
And why did your father do that?
Okay, because of all the options, like anywhere from like LA to Chicago to a couple of other ones, the closest one that my parents could relocate to and then be able to drive down back to Miami was New Jersey. Because, you know, they're going, okay, we're going to be relocated, but we don't know. We don't know if we're going to like it or, you know, what our life is going to be like living in a place like that is cold. And my parents had never seen snow. I mean, my whole family.
Wow.
We were from the Caribbean. And all of a sudden,
right.
Miami was as close as we could get, 90 miles from.
Why did they want to leave Miami?
Because there were not enough jobs. It was kind of like, we're going to relocate you. Where do you want to go, basically? And this was a program that was run not only by the government, but also through the Catholic Church. And my parents, they wanted a better life, and my dad could not get jobs. There was not enough jobs in industries in Miami. And so he said, okay, yeah, we're going to relocate to New Jersey. And but what happened was, when I got there, I noticed for the first time that ethnic groups would not mingle with each other. You know, like the Irish kept with the Irish, and in school, the kids,
And what was the neighborhood that you were in this in New
West
Jersey?
New York, West New York, you know, like
And what was
Bergen.
ethnically, what was
Well, it was pretty much like in New York, you know, it was like each block had an ethnic group living in it. Italians and Irish and Germans, and most of the Afro-Americans were in Newark. And what else? And then the Cubans started coming in little by little. And but what I'm saying is, when I first got there, it was you know, very segmented. Nobody really mingled with each other. And then once the Beatles, you know, music, the British invasion started happening, the kids in school all of a sudden saw that as like, now we belong to the same tribe musically, you know. So that's when I started going over to everybody else's home and listening to music, got to meet their families. And, you know, that broke down so many barriers. Because the first thing you realize is we're all the same. No matter what the ethnic group is, we all want the same thing. We want positive, good things for our family and for ourselves. You know, we want to do good, we want to be friendly, but people fear the unknown. The unknown. And I'll tell you something. Okay, this is what music does. If you're walking down the street, it's late at night, and it's dark, and you're by yourself, and you see somebody walking towards you. If they're wearing a Led Zeppelin or an AC/DC shirt, you're going to feel much safer about that individual, because all of a sudden you connect with them. You resonate. Oh, just like me, they're into rock and roll, so they must be okay. That's the power of music.
Yeah, I get it. And I think that's absolutely true. That makes total sense to me. So, okay, so the Beatles happened. You haven't started playing music yet. Does it right away you go, okay, that's what I'm going to do.
Well, what happened with the Beatles? My attraction initially was that I was overweight from eating all of the army rations that they were giving my family. You know, we were refugees, so in order to help us economically, they were like, my mom would take my brother and me, we'll go downtown Miami, and she would pick up army rations, like the government cheese, Spam, powdered eggs, powdered milk, peanut butter. And they were in a can, and it says Army, US Army. Well, you know, so there's a lot of preserves in that. And when you're eating that many preserves as a kid, you start gaining weight. You know, I mean, that's okay for a soldier, I guess, because you're in the field. But if you're growing up, it has an effect on your hormones. It did on me completely. So I was very overweight. Plus, my mom liked to, back in the day, she liked to cook with lard. That's the way they used to cook in the 50s. Lard. And then after that, you know, when things started changing, she used certain oils and things like that. But that was later on. At that time, I was eating lard, you know, with every meal, you know.
Wow.
And so I'm overweight, in a I can't speak, I can't communicate, you know, with the girls in school. So here comes the Beatles. And if the camera would have not panned from where, you know, focusing on the Beatles, and then the camera pan over to the girls in the audience going insane, it would have been a different story for me. But once it did, and I saw the girls reacting to the Beatles like that, I said, that's it. I want that. I want that adulation. And so I said, okay, I'm going to become a musician. Of course, that's for all the wrong reasons, but that was my initial spark as to why I wanted to play. Then I fell in love with music. You know, music is oxygen to me. Playing, it's you know, of course, you know, I have my family, and but music it's my personal identity. I am a musician and a husband.
Okay, so let's talk about that. I'm sorry, I was distracted because things were coming up wrong and I was just trying to change them. You've been married for almost 40 years, is that true?
I'm going to be 40 June 2024th this year, yeah.
Okay, in regular people land, that is a miracle. In the land of rock and roll, that is astounding how you could have this career and how on earth, we're going to get back to the pandemic and all of that, how that's changed you, but how on earth do you guys, how have you managed to keep a marriage fruitful and working, being on the road, being gone so much, having, I'm sure, women making themselves more than available to you on a regular basis. What on earth?
It's very simple. You have to ask, I have integrity, you know, with that. And it's not just with my family, it's with my music and everything that I do in life. You know, I could not live any other way. I make a commitment and sometimes I make bad decisions, but I'm committed to see this through because I made a commitment. You know, I mean, I can't walk away from the situation in the middle of it and say, I'm out. No, I can't. I say, okay, I made a mistake. I'll never do this again, but I'm going to take it all the way to the end, you know. And with the family, with my wife, our relationship, why marry somebody and make a promise in front of God that you're going to do the things that you take the vow and you say, I'm going to do these things, and then all of a sudden break the vow? No. Why get married if you're going to do that? What's the point? You know, to make a commitment and then break the commitment, because if you're going to do that, you're going to break every other commitment pretty much that you make in the rest of your life.
So is this the way you were raised, Rudy? Is this part of your religious upbringing? Is this part of your moral upbringing? Is it both?
Yeah, I think it's more moral than religious upbringing, because I'm a Christian, but it's like Christianity was not, and my parents were Christians too, but it's not like they were Bible thumpers. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like they had morals, beautiful morals, which I learned that from them. I inherited their morals. So it was more of a moral decision or lifestyle, you know. And my father, a man of, and my mom, both incredible integrity. So of course, you know, they lead by example. And then as far as my musical career, playing with Randy Rhoads, I would say that was my foundation for, as far as music goes, having integrity in what I do, as far as my career, you know, musical side of it, of things, because you have the family and you have your music, you know. And so from Randy, I learned so much from him. Again, he led by his example. Another one that I learned from was Ronnie James Dio.
How so?
Okay, from Randy. Randy was the only musician I've ever played with that came from a academic, music academic family, music professors. He started playing guitar at a very early age. I'm talking about 4 or 5 years old. Then he started learning, you know, reading music and theory, harmony, composition, all of that. He was incredibly, he was the most well-rounded guitar player I've ever played with. He was a professor. He was a teacher. He used to teach at school, that his parents' school, you know, Musonia, which is in North Hollywood, still there. And I saw two different versions of Randy. I saw Randy as the guitar player in Quiet Riot, the local band, who was trying so hard to get a record deal. And we were just neglected by all the record companies in town, because at that time, 78, 79, 1978, 1979, the genre that was the most popular was new wave and punk at that time. So they were not interested in signing some glam band, because that was out of mode by then, you know, which most of the bands on the Sunset Strip, that's what we were doing. You know, there was early incarnations of Motley Crue. The Nikki Sixx had a band called London. Then you have Mickey Rat, which turned into Rat. You had Dokken. You had another version of what became known as Great White. You know, so a lot of the bands that became hits during the 80s on MTV, they were already, we were all struggling to keep it together. By keeping together, it's like to stay in LA and not leave. I had to leave a couple of times because I kept running out of money. But by 1978, I came to stay in LA. And that's when I joined the Randy Rose version of Quiet Riot. And then I play with him in Ozzy Osbourne. And that was a whole different level of Randy's musical integrity. When he received the best new guitar player in Guitar Player magazine in was December 30th, 1981, which was the first, it was the opening night of the Diary of the Madman tour. We were playing the Cow Palace in San Francisco. And remember, there's no social media. So, you know, you would do a show, the Ozzy Osbourne, you know, the band, we would do a show and get off the station, go into the bus, tour bus, and leave town immediately. So we would meet anybody. Nobody would come up backstage and say, hey, you know, talk to Randy and tell him, hey, I love your playing and blah, blah, blah. No, it's like we were gone. So we had no idea. Did anybody like this? Or, I mean, we could see the crowd getting into it, but, you know, you want to hear, you want to hear a response that nowadays you go to Instagram and people are already posting photos and comments about what you just played, you know, half an hour before, you know, but not that time. So once he received that award, he said, wow, people are really listening to what I've created and recorded and playing. So he decided to get deeper into classical guitar. So that's backstage during the Diary of a Madman tour. That's what he would play mostly. And every time we would arrive in the morning,
yeah,
from, you know, having traveled in the tour bus to the next hotel, we would go to breakfast, and he pulls out the local Yellow Pages and looks for an appropriate, the biggest ad from the music schools in town to find a teacher so he could learn more about classical. And most of the times, of course, he was more educated than whatever teacher happened to be there, but he was still paid for the lesson. He would give the teacher a lesson himself.
Wow. You know, I've noticed through first meeting you and through all the years, through everything I've read and through everything I see on your pages, and you have such a beautiful loyalty, not only to your wife, but to Randy. You've carried him with you in his memory all these years, and you've kept him alive, really, for all the fans. It's a beautiful thing. This moral sense that you have, this
yeah.
It's a beautiful thing, Rudy. It's really admirable. And so how did you guys meet? How did you begin to make music together?
I did an audition for Quiet Riot. I was out of town when I got the call, and I happened to be already had the tickets to go back to LA within a few days. So once I
Were
arrived
you
in LA, I
already playing at that level? Were you already playing at a high level? Wasn't Quiet Riot your first big?
Well, when I say big, I would say Quiet Riot at that time was like the big local band, still a local band, very young. They have ways to go. Not as much Randy, but Randy was ready to go by the time I joined. I'm talking about the other members in the group, because of course they didn't have the music education that Randy did. That made a huge difference, When you are 4 or 5 years old, you're already getting an education. By the time you're a teenager, you're pretty much like, okay, I got enough knowledge, so now I can start internal. Not only you, it's a self-realization that you have because you have internalized all this information. Now you're teaching yourself. You're being creative. But if you don't have that information, you're basically you might have it in your head, but how am I going to get this into my hands and play it? But if you have the information on how to do it, oh yeah, what you're hearing in your head is this certain mode you're playing, or this certain scale, or this certain chord pattern. Now you really understand what you're imagining, and it's easier to manifest. And that's what Randy had over everybody else that in the band. He could play whatever he heard in his head, he could play right out there immediately.
Did you know when you signed on, did you have the sense, okay, this is gonna happen?
Oh, there's never a guarantee, but of all the previous experiences, this was the most promising, the most together, because he had a vision. A very defined, focused vision, because it was an original band. Meaning, yes, they quite right did some covers when I first joined in 78, but the vision was to be an original band, not a cover band, And for the first time, I was playing with an original band, because prior to that, most of the bands that I play with, I would just say everybody, they were just cover bands so we could make money to get us to LA. And then once we got to LA, we had to find a few more members. But Quiet Riot was pretty much complete and already had the vision.
And so why did Randy leave, which then led to you leaving? What happened there?
Well, when Randy left, well, it's because, like I mentioned before, the style of music that we were doing was not what the record companies were looking for. They were looking for punk and new wave. So basically, along with Randy, we were just hitting our heads against the wall. And he got offered by Ozzy to join him in the band, putting a new band together. And his family said, listen, if you don't take this opportunity, this might be your only chance. You just never know. This is, sometimes you got to live in the now. And you look at your options right now, and you got to make a decision, because that window might close at some point quickly.
And so when he left and he brought you into Ozzy, so now you're doing Ozzy, and that was in the middle of Ozzy's crazy, right? He
Yeah,
was.
but there was a about a year and a half period. So a lot happened in that period, which basically that Randy got to record two albums along with Ozzy, and then Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake. They recorded the Blizzard of Oz album and the Diary of a Madman album, and then when and but meanwhile, I was still in LA, and the band Quiet Riot ceased to exist. as a band, as a brand, Quiet Riot. It became Dubrow. Kevin put his own band together. And I used to play with him on and off because everybody was doing different projects. And then I moved in with Kevin. I pretty much steadily started playing with him. And then I got to join Ozzy in 1981. But so there was about a year and a half period that it took for that to come to fruition. And then Randy, that's 1981. Randy passes in 1982. And I lost the joy of making music because, you know, when I was playing with Ozzy and Tommy Aldridge, they have been around doing it for like 16 years. You know, they were veterans, but Randy and I, we were just getting started with our music career. And so these are, to me, these are the people that I grew up playing with, going through all the pains of being rejected by labels and finally seeing the light, and then we're playing in front of thousands of people. It's very different than when you join a band and these guys they've been there, done that. You know, it's a whole different relationship. And so once I lost that connection, I lost the joy of playing because I couldn't connect emotionally with anybody at that level of my journey as a musician that's just getting started. So in September of 1982, Randy passes away March 19th. And then in September, I was getting ready. I'm in LA and I'm getting ready to go to New York to record Speak of the Devil, the Ozzy Black Sabbath era re-recordings with Tommy Aldridge and Brad Gillis, who by then was a guitar player. And I get a phone call from Kevin saying, "Hey, Roots, we're in the studio. It's a possible record deal. How would you like to come down and do us a tribute to Randy as Thunderbird," which is a song that Kevin wrote for Randy when Randy left the band, Quiet Riot, to join Ozzy. So I used to play that song with Kevin in Dubrow. And so I go down to the studio and there's Frankie Benelli, who I left Florida with him and wound up in Chicago, and we started playing the whole Chicago circuit. And then we wound up in LA in 77. And, you know, we tried so hard to keep it together as a rhythm section, but we ran out of money. So we split. And then I came back in 78, and that's when I joined Quiet Riot. So we haven't really played together since 77. And finally, this is 1982, like 5 years later, we're finally in the studio recording as a rhythm section. The band was still called Dubrow. It was not called Quiet Riot yet. It got renamed Quiet Riot once I officially left Ozzy a few weeks after this, that we're talking about this recording session. And I came back to playing with Frankie and Kevin. Then it got renamed Quiet Riot. Carlos Cavazo, I had never met him before, but he was a member of Dubrow at that moment. And so I did Thunderbird. We did it really fast because I knew the song. I used to play it. So then the producer says, "Hey, do you remember Slick Black Cadillac?" Which is the only song that made it from the Mental Health, from the Randy Rose era to the Mental Health record. And so we cut it. And then we did a couple of other Dubrow songs, Dubrow era songs, which is Love's a Bitch and Let's Get Crazy. So by the time that I left the session, I already done four songs for what became known as the Mental Health record, Quiet Riot's Mental Health. And there was a lot of joy at that moment of having played with Frankie, who we've been struggling for almost 10 years to play together, you know, do in a band, record. And then, of course, with Kevin, so I used to play with in Quiet Riot with Randy, and then I live with him, and I play with him in Dubrow. So I went back to New York, and we did the Speak of the Devil two nights at the Ritz in New York. And then I went back to LA and made the toughest decision I've ever made, which is to leave Ozzy, one of the biggest bands in the world. And they treated me great. Sharon, Ozzy, they were fantastic with me. Beautiful. But I needed to get the joy of making music again. Without that, I'm nothing. I'm not even playing notes. I'm just being miserable, you know. So I did. I went back, and then I finished the record, the tracks that I needed to finish, and the record about a year later goes to number one. You know, nobody could predict that. No, not even close. You know, we were hoping to sell, you know, enough records to get a second record, because that was the norm back then. You know, you make a record and you just sell enough to do the second one, because the record right. company has recouped on the first one.
Right, right.
You know, yeah.
And how about Whitesnake? That was like a whole, God, the whole, you were blonde, your hair band, you guys were huge, a whole different kind of vibe for you.
Yeah.
Was that, Whitesnake, did you have joy with that music? Was that fun for you?
Oh, super fun. See, Whitesnake was the special guest 10 years ago to Quiet Riot in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
We were on tour for the Condition Critical album, which was the second album that we recorded. And so I got to know the guys really well, hung out with them. And the last night of the tour, we threw a little party, going away party for them. And as we were saying goodbye, Coverdale gives me a hug and whispers in my ear, "We're going to be playing soon again." I mean, playing soon together, not again, but together. And I'm thinking, how does he know that I gave notice to the band? Because I had before we started the tour, but I made a commitment. I couldn't, you know, something happened that I said, okay, this is terrible, but, you know, I signed contracts and committed to do this tour, and I'm sticking with it. And that's how I got to meet David and so in 85, when all my commitments to the Condition Critical tour that were completed, I left the band, and then I got a phone call. I was Tommy Elders and I were putting together a band at that time. I got a phone call from Whitesnake's management that, you know, to come into the office so we could talk, and we did. And they offer us the spot as the rhythm section. But there was still one member in the group, very talented, but I knew there was a lot of conflict between that member and Coverdale. So I thought, you know what? I just left one situation. I really don't want to get into another one. So I passed on it. So a couple of years later, the only remaining member of Whitesnake was David. And we get the offer again. And this time we met for the first time with Vivian Campbell and Adrian Vandenberg, and of course David, to do the Still of the Night video. We were not officially in the band at that time. It was,
you know, it we, was like they had morals.
You know, when we met at the actual video, mm-hmm. you know, video shoot, that's when we hit it off. And of course, I knew David from having tour with him and, you know, Whitesnake and Quiet Riot.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that's what happened. I had a blast. As a matter of fact, I've been transferring from mini video VHS cassettes to digital footage that I took during those tours. And we had a blast. We really did, because it's been captured. Yeah. A lot of
absolutely.
Great memories.
Absolutely. Did your parents live to see you have this great success?
Oh yeah, absolutely. They used to come to the shows every time I played in Miami. Yeah, the first time they saw me was with Ozzy.
And what did they think of that?
I wrote about her in the book. I wrote Off the Rails, a book that I wrote for Randy. And it's funny because, you know, my mom grew up in a musical family. She had sisters who were entertainers and singers. So she knew, you know, she could tell, you know, the quality of the entertainers. And she liked the band, but she wasn't sure about Ozzy. Ozzy was having one of those nights, you know.
Mm. So let's talk about one of those nights. So I know I'm a sober woman. I know you're a sober man. You were with Ozzy when all of that talk about going off the rails, which I assume has a double entendre there with Ozzy. Were you going off the rails when Ozzy was going off the rails? How were you handling all of that back then?
Well, that's a good question. But so I have to go to the beginning of it. What really has saved me throughout my all this time I've been doing this at this level since 1981 is that prior to 1981, prior to getting the phone call to join Ozzy, I made peace with God. I was sleeping on the floor in Kevin DeBro's spare bedroom in an apartment in Sherman Oaks, a shag carpeting and a sheet, not even a mattress, right?
Oh, God. So,
but I was reading the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New One, and I was deeply, I got the calling, and I made peace with God that as long as my fingers were going to keep moving, I was going to keep playing. That was my sign. Keep going. Keep moving forward, you know. But if I never made it, that's okay. My relationship with God was more important than anything else. And at the lowest point of my career, I had the strongest faith.
Wow.
Or feeling that strongest faith for the first time. So by the time that I joined Ozzy a few days later, I had that very strong spiritual center. So one of the reasons why I got the Ozzy gig, as Randy tells me, was because they were looking for somebody who was not going to be a bad influence on Ozzy. If you can imagine that, how bad can you be? Do you have to be to be a bad influence? So I passed the test, right? I mean, I of course I knew I had to know how to play the songs and all of that, but don't be a bad influence on Ozzy. So, but what's funny is once I passed the bad influence audition, I was asked to become his drinking buddy because Randy had been, prior to me joining the band, his drinking, buddy, hanging out. Right. And Tommy Aldridge had been doing this for a long time by then. So he didn't want to take, he didn't want any part of that. So I was the de facto, the new guy. You get to hang out with us. And I thought, wow, how cool is that? I'm going to get to hang out and I'm a fan. He's a icon. What could go wrong? I learned a lot.
So did it escalate your drinking and using? I imagine that it did.
Yes, it did quickly. Mm-hmm. which it happened. The good thing about it happened quickly was that as quickly as I started drinking more, I quickly stopped because I hit the wall very fast. You know what I mean? It was like one of those moments of clarity where you say, you know what? I was 30 by then. And I'm going, I have not struggled all these years to get to this point and then just blow it by drinking and partying. I don't have the same constitution as Ozzy does. Ozzy was drinking, it was part then of the English pub culture. Everything was built around a program about going to the pub for lunch. Then they closed the pub, then they opened it again for dinner. Guys in the road crew, they had alarms in their little 1981 digital watches that would say, oh, pub's open, and we stop whatever we're doing and go to the pub, because that was a priority, and it culturally was completely different. Back in England back then, remember, they, these are, when Ozzy was a child, he was playing in the rubble of the Blitzkrieg, the bombings, when the Germans bombed the UK every night, and after the war, it took him a long time to rebuild England. So when he was a kid, he would go on the streets and buildings are missing. So they would go in this empty, this lot that is just a debris from a bombing. And that was the playground, you know, in Birmingham, a industrial city, you know, a lot of smoke and, you know, suits and dirt all over the place, you know. I mean, what do you think heavy metal came from? It didn't come because, like, I was raised in the Caribbean, and then the sunny beaches of Miami Beach. It's a completely different environment for Randy too. You know, he's born right. from L.A., Burbank, and just going to Malibu and hanging out, getting a suntan. Then we're playing with this guy who comes from Birmingham in England. You know, they rarely see the sun. You know, so it's like. You know, it's an interesting mix, but it's we get to learn about each other. You know,
did you have because you didn't get completely sober then, did you?
Oh no, I got completely sober 26 years ago.
And yeah. Did you have a spiritual awakening then? What caused you? Did you have a what did you have a spiritual awakening? What happened? Why did you get sober?
I had an out-of-body experience.
Wow, wait, what? What happened?
Yeah, I saw myself drunk from above. I was hovering over myself and I'm looking at myself and I'm going, I am despicable. I become the person that I would not want to hang out with or be like. What's going on? So, yeah, I actually saw myself yelling at my wife, you know, but just belligerent. No nonsense. It was like, why am I doing this? Where's this coming from? Because it was like one of the things that had no origin whatsoever. It was just this spurt of drunken madness.
Did your drinking ever get you in trouble? Did you ever miss gigs or flights or did you ever play drunk?
No.
Did you no?
No, no, no. That was another thing. No, I only drank at home. I mean, I would drink on the road on days off.
Mm-hmm.
No, and I mean, going on the road was, as a matter of fact, I remember doing tours where I was completely dry, and then I would go home and celebrate.
Right.
Because what would happen is, so let's say I start playing with Ozzy. And remember, you know, one thing I have to mention is, when I was a starving musician, first of all, I couldn't afford to drink. So I could not afford to be a drunk. Second of all, I was originally playing in Florida, where you know, it's the environment that all the clubs that had bands, and you were talking about the days where there was no DJs, really. You had to have a light band. People were not interested and listen to a record, even though disco came in later on. I'm talking about late 60s, early 70s. So it was all live music. And the band had to be an attraction. And, you know, there was always some kind of like ladies' night or such special drinks certain days. So if you wanted to drink, it was cheap. But I said, no, I can't drink and play. It's just going to get in the way of my, you know, being professional, you know. And so I, during the starving musician period, I was dry. Plus, hanging out of the Rainbow, I would see some of my heroes in big bands being completely out of it. And I said, I don't want to be like this guy. You know, it's a shame. He's my hero. And he's like, but, you know, belligerent and wasted. No, I don't want that. So, you know, there were certain choices that I made just based on my own morals. And the fact that my hero was twice as talented as me, but nobody wanted to play with him now because he's a total drunk. So I say, no, drunkenness that equals destroying your career. And I had not left Miami to go to LA and become a drunk. I could have stayed in Miami and do drugs, drunk and just like every other musician that I knew that decided to stay, because they kept saying, why should I live LA? I mean, Miami, I got everything that I need here, and I'm living a rock and roll star lifestyle. Women, you know, drugs, alcohol, cars, whatever. The weather is great, you know, the beaches. Why should I suffer and become a you know, a struggling musician? I said, well, you know, for me, there's no music industry here. I don't want to be playing covers for the rest of my life. This is not what I want to do. I want to be a professional recording and touring musician. So that's why I went. I did the whole that whole journey that led me to LA, that led me to playing with Quiet Riot, and you know, the Randy Rhoads era. And so I had a vision of what I needed to be like in order to achieve something. But then once you achieve that level, especially with Ozzy, because everything took off really quickly.
Right.
There was a lot of celebration going on.
Oh, so, yeah.
So celebration equals success equals celebration equals getting wasted.
Right.
And I'm going like.
And everybody's giving it to you, right? Because everybody's giving you everything.
Yeah. And one important factor is you were not trusted unless you partake.
By the your bandmates, not by the outside, by the
Well, you know, your inner right. circle is like, oh, I don't trust this guy. He's not getting high with me,
right?
You know, so that I'm not talking just about Ozzy in particular. I'm talking about the whole music industry.
Right.
I mean, there were like maybe three or four guys that were straight back then: Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley, and maybe two more. I don't know who they were because I never met them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was pretty much the way it was. And it just became like a level. How much of a drinker are you? So I chose to say, okay, I'm going to like curtail myself on the road, never drink on stage, never in the studio. When I'm home, okay. This is it. This is my me time, my personal time. And even that, I mean, towards the end, when I was starting to like really contemplate cutting down my drinking, I was very, very organized about it. I would schedule it. And I would not leave the house. I would throw parties because I didn't want to drive under the influence. So I would throw parties and people would come over and we you know, we hang out and drink and stuff. Yeah.
Was it difficult to quit? You sound so disciplined. Was it not difficult to quit when you made the decision? Did you not struggle with it?
No, not at all.
Wow.
Completely. I saw myself out of body experience, and anytime that I had any doubt about why am I sober, I will flash back on that moment, and that moment kept me on the straight and narrow because I did not join a program until COVID happened.
Okay, so let's talk about COVID now because we started to do that at the beginning. So you're down in Florida, You're doing
Epcot Center, Orlando.
You're down in Epcot Center. You're doing a residency.
Yeah.
You're playing now for four people. They shut the thing down. What happens to Rudy Sarzo?
I get on a plane the next day and come to LA and go home. And it was like a decision that actually I made on the plane. I said, you know what? I think there's going to be a while. I'm going to use this time to improve myself as a musician, as a human being. I'm really interested in finding out the healing qualities of music, you know, and I started going down the rabbit hole on YouTube, starting with
Now, was
Tesla.
That something, did you do that with a specific, was it for children? Was it for people that were ill? Was it for everyone in general?
Everyone in general.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, Music doesn't know how old you are, what background you come from, male or female.
Whether you're healthy or well.
Yeah, it doesn't care. It's a wave, and a wave can be anything. it's a frequent, you know, because I wound up in the quantum field, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the quantum field, you got waves. And then once you observe the wave, it becomes a particle. It's a thought. It's a thought. For example, okay. You had a thought about who am I going to get, guests for my show. I became one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thought.
Okay.
Right. And then you manifested that by sending me an email inviting me to come to the show. We pick mm-hmm. a date and a time. Mm-hmm. And here we are. We're doing this. Now, mm-hmm. this is going to have a life beyond this moment that we're speaking, because correct. It's going to go on the internet and it's going to be offered for anybody for the next so many years. It could be eternity. Who knows? For a long time. Mm-hmm. This is going to live. This moment that we're talking is going to outlive us.
Probably.
You know, but it started with a thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a reality and, you know, it manifested itself. Everything around us. You know, if you look at that microphone in front of you, that started with a thought. That microphone did not exist at one point until an engineer or a manufacturer say contacted an engineer, you know, however mm-hmm. it happens. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say you're a manufacturer and you have engineers and your staff and says, listen, I need this special microphone. It's going to be different from all the other microphones. And it's going to have certain qualities. At this moment, it's just a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Then the engineer goes down, puts it on paper, the design, and then at some point it's the microphone. It's gone from mm-hmm. the thought to the paper, the schematics of what the makeup of the circuitry of the microphone,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody creates it.
Mm-hmm.
Particles. We all made out of the same particles. That microphone is made out of the same molecules as you are. Nothing. We are stardust.
We are stardust. We are golden.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So explain to me how this, so music and healing, explain to yeah. me how this translates to music and healing.
Yes. There's going to be, you know, this is a very controversial subject because we're talking about using frequencies that are copacetic, that are not, let's say, 440 tuning. Or the 440 frequency, it's not copacetic with cymatics. Cymatics is, for example, you take 432. If you put the frequency of 432, it's going to create a certain design, whether you're using any of the elements, whether you're using water, or whether you're using particles like dust or sand or salt, it's going to create a pattern. Water will create a pattern. All of that, but it has to be a frequency that is in tune with the elements. We are about 90% liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Our bodies are made mm-hmm. out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so imagine a frequency that has effect on water. It's going to have the same effect on the liquid within our bodies. And as long as it's a healing frequency, is what they call the solfeggio. All the notes in the solfeggio are in tune to certain frequencies that will create the clear cymatic patterns.
They're so like is this musical, Rudy, or is it more like sounds that you hear when you meditate?
Yeah, sounds. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. but what is music? Music is sound. It's a sequence mm-hmm. of notes.
Mm-hmm.
It's
That's
pattern.
True.
It's mm-hmm. it's rhythm. Rhythm mm-hmm. it's all of the components put together to create a song. It could be anything. It could be a symphony, it could be a nursery rhyme.
Mm.
Still music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you tune into just one note, now it becomes a drone. And if you study certain religion, like Om, mm-hmm. it's just one note, you know, and you're resonating with that, you know. It's not any different than singing. The only difference is it's just one note.
Mm-hmm.
And it's continuous and it's making you vibrate. It's tuning. You're in tune with, it's called music of the spheres. by and Sogres.
So what happens to us when we listen to healing music?
Well, you have to have yourself in a certain stage. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's say, in what capacity you're talking about? You're talking about a concert? Let's say you go and watch a band, or are you meditating?
Yeah, I'm thinking it's more personal than that, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine going to a concert of healing music. Does that exist? I don't know.
Okay, well, let me tell you this is what I do.
Okay.
I play events, gatherings, right? And so let's say you were talking about Whitesnake. You know, I did a lot of festivals with Whitesnake that we were the headliners.
Right.
You know, and when Whitesnake had attracted for whatever reason, musically, visual, because we had certain videos that represented certain things at a certain time, right? So we're talking about the 80s, and the band, and I tell you this because I, from experience, there was a purpose for the certain individuals being in that group, was to appeal to the MTV generation.
Right.
The image, because originally Whitesnake was a blues-based band, was very different in the 70s than what it became known as the 87 version of the band, mm-hmm. when it broke into MTV, and I happened to be a member of that. So it was very orchestrated to appeal to that collective consciousness of people mm-hmm. watching MTV, right? Mm-hmm. And so it resonated with a certain demographic because of Tawny Kitaen being in the videos. All of a sudden, there were a lot of girls coming to see the band, you know, and because they wanted to be like her. You know, she was like a pioneer in the video vixen, mm-hmm. you know, category. And so let's say you were back in the 80s. You get your, usually, because I tell you, from stage, I could see that it's girls' night out. By the time that the band became a headliner, because we started first opening up for Motley Crue, by the time we became headliners and we had about three or four videos out, it was definitely girls' night out because I could see it from the audience. I mean, from the wow. stage into the audience, you know? So let's say you get two or three girlfriends, so let's go and see Whitesnake perform tonight, right? Girls' night out, and you leave the house, you park the car, you go through the arena, and maybe you buy a shirt because you want to represent, you know, even after the show is done. I was there. It's a tour mm-hmm. shirt, right? Okay. And then maybe you get some food, maybe you get a drink, and you sit there and you watch the show. And we, every single band I've been in, that we've been very careful to how to pick the opening band. Because the opening band has to be very relative to your audience. You all of a sudden, you're not going to bring an opening band that is kind of like the audience is going to go, why am I watching these guys? Right. The headliner is this type of music, so it has to be kind of like relative mm-hmm. to it, mm-hmm. you know, somehow. Mm-hmm. and appeal mm-hmm. And get the crowd going and that collective consciousness, you know, preparing them for the headliner,
mm-hmm.
you know, and because I also been in the opening bands and I know right. what our job is, you know, to prepare the crowd for the headliner.
Right.
And so what happens is, you know, what we do as musicians is we create frequencies. That's what we do. They come through the speakers. And when you're in a concert, you're basically shoulder to shoulder with everybody around you. Our internal frequencies has a span of about 6 feet out, spreading out from the center of our body. So when you're standing that close to somebody, it's going to crossfading your frequency. You're in tune because you're both listening to the same frequencies. the same waves, right? And all of a sudden, you feel exactly the same emotion as the person standing next to you. It's a collective consciousness gathering for that, right? And with every song, it keeps adding up and adding up. And before you know, and but you're not aware of this. You're caught in the moment because the band is making a presentation. And nowadays, there's a certain style of production that we didn't have for 30, 40 years ago, which is the big screens with a lot of information flashing at you. So it's information overload, plus the waves. So not only are you stimulated because the visuals have waves also. You look at a photo, you go look at a painting, you look at colors. Each color has a wave, a sound, a frequency to it. Because we're not really seeing it. We're reading the frequency. That's how we see things, as frequencies. You know, we hear things, you know. And before you know it, the whole place, if the headliner has done their job, everybody leaves and they're exactly in tune equally.
I love that.
From this collective collective consciousness experience. And that's why people go back, because they said, I saw this band, and sometimes they can't explain it because they're not aware of what they just experienced. They just know that they want to feel the same way again. So sometimes, like when I was playing with Ozzy, we start building an audience because, let's say, the audience not expecting, they don't know anything about Randy. All they know is, oh, yeah, it's the guy from Black Sabbath. Okay, yeah, I'm a Black Sabbath fan. I'm going to go and watch the band. Then they'll go and go, who's this guy? It's happened to me with different bands. I mean, I've seen bands that I have no expectation. I go and I watch somebody and go, who's this person? Where did it come from? So I start like, I want more. I want more of that.
Right. Yeah,
because it resonated with me. So that's how we built the Ozzy Osbourne, the Blizzard of Oz tour was built on that. It was at a time where our tour was routed that we would do legs. We would do like the Northeast. We'd do like 6 weeks up here. Then we'd go the Midwest, 6 weeks there. Then we could do Texas. Back then you could do 6 weeks in Texas. Play everywhere in Texas, right? And then you go to the Northwest. But what I'm talking about is that every show was within 100 miles from each other. So if you like what you saw
tonight, you could then go to the other show.
Drive for a couple of hours, bring your friends. You gotta see these guys because there's nothing on YouTube. It's not even MTV. The MTV's not even out there yet. Listen, you gotta see this for yourself. And so they bring their friends. And I tell you, I saw that in front of me. I said, yeah, I saw these guys last night. They're here again. And they got more friends with them. That's how the band grew really exponentially, really fast. We went from the Blizzard of Oz tour playing mostly theaters to the Diary of a Madman. We started playing some arenas once Def Leppard joined us because, again, they brought in the girls. They brought in the first, when we had Motorhead opening up for us, it was very male, male audience.
Right.
Once they start bringing the girls, now you doubled your audience. Now you got males and females there. So now we're playing arenas. Yeah. But then again, it all comes down to that collective consciousness.
Okay, so since the pandemic, which you say has changed you, go back to that. How has the pandemic changed you?
Well, it's made me more aware of the virtual reality world that we live in. Mm-hmm. By that I mean is there's so many options. Right now, we've chosen to be this. Mm-hmm. Right now, this experience, right? I could get off this couch right now, this chair, and go to Costco. That would change my it will be an alternate reality. But there's a version of me at Costco right now. There's a version of me somewhere else, living, having a whole different experience. I just have not made that decision yet, or might never make it. But it does exist. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what at the core of what, you know, the alternate realities that we experience, I mean, that are ready for us to experience upon what decisions we have to make at the moment.
So are you making different decisions as a result of, I feel forever changed from COVID?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So you bring up a really good question. The best way that I can answer that question is, one thing that I, once COVID happened, there were people in my family that all of a sudden decided to, like, you know what, I'm going to investigate Zoom AA meetings. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, you know what, I'm sober. I want to check it out because, yeah, I'm home, you know. Mm-hmm. So I started watching it. I'm going like, oh, wow, wait a minute. I'm just like these people.
Because you hadn't been going to meetings before.
No. I thought I was a guy who, just like my dad, one day he stopped drinking that one beer that he used to drink when he came home from work at dinner time. Mm-hmm. One day he just stopped. He did the same thing with cigarettes. Mm-hmm. One day he stopped smoking cigarettes.
My father too. Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the day, they didn't have rehabs or anything. You know, we're talking about 60s and 50s. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's it. Then I said, wait a minute. I have these symptoms. I have an alcoholic brain. Mm-hmm. I have an alcohol. I think like an alcoholic. Well, I found out that I did and became aware of it. So I watch myself when I make decisions. Mm-hmm. I used to like shoot from the hip and make decisions that I thought, well, if my voice in my head's telling me do this or that, since it's coming from my head, it must be the right decision. Then I realized that's the wrong voice to listen to, because it's my alcoholic voice giving me terrible advice as an alcoholic. So I learned how to like turn that voice down, turn it down. And be aware, and when thoughts are like, no, I'm not going to do this just because you thought of it, that's a horrible decision or direction to take my life in, you know. So that was the first major change that going to AA gave me, made me realize I am an alcoholic. And there's ways to actually fix this or reprogram. It's the AA program. And what happens is you can reprogram yourself to do, you have free will. You have the free will to do God's will, which is the right path, or you got the free will to do, take the wrong path. It's up to the individual, you know, and I have to examine every decision that I make and every step just to make sure that I'm staying on the right, correct lane of my journey, not to deviate, no detours. I used to take a lot of detours.
I've been in recovery for over 20 years. I still take detours. I'm a work in progress, and it's progress, not perfection, right? So I still make mistakes on a regular basis. I work at it very diligently, absolutely. But I still struggle. Yeah. Cause I still have, you know, willful mind and all of that. So, so Rudy, did you get COVID during all of this? Have you had it?
No.
Good for you. Oh God. I just got it for the first time, and it was horrific. It was why I avoided it like the plague. Ugh.
I have four shots. I've had all the shots
and everything.
Really?
And you got it too?
Oh, wow.
And I got it. And it was bad. I was sick for like a month. It was awful. Oh, wow. But so Do you live life differently aside from the online AA meetings? Do you live life differently now? Are you back to, do you live life the way you did before COVID? Is life forever changed? Are you semi back? What would you say? Because you travel a lot now again, right?
Yeah. And it's really a combination of not just the COVID period. I think the COVID period really prepared me to actually be, you know, to what I'm doing now, which is I'm back full circle with Quiet Riot, you know, where I started and where I got my, what I call my musical home, you know. And when I talk about Quiet Riot, I'm talking about 1978, because it was, this is what happened. Randy Rhoads was he led by example. He was the leader, you know, of the band. When I first joined the band, it was very quick. I realized very quickly that Kevin Dubrow's, I won't call it a job, but what he really did was to put the spotlight on Randy. It was like the ringmaster, and Randy is like the main attraction, you know. And I got it really quickly. I mean, I have been doing, by then I have been around for long enough to actually realize how this band, the structure of it functions, you know. And I said, this is correct, because you're putting the spotlight on the right person, not on yourself as being the singer, but you're saying, take this guy out, right?
Right.
And once Randy left and he joined Quiet Riot, and then I joined him. See, I'm the only guy who actually got to experience the full.
You mean
Randy.
When he left and joined Ozzy, you mean?
Yeah. When he left to join Ozzy, then he became a next level Randy Rhoads. He became the Randy Rhoads that is in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
He's there by himself, not even with a band. It's just Randy Rhoads in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by himself. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get it. He goes, I lived it. I was there with him in Quiet Riot, then I was there with him with Ozzy. I got it. And he affected my whole life. I know. I got it. So I know why.
And
he
was
there.
So young. How old was he when he
26 when he passed away.
Unbelievable that he could have such influence.
Yes. So I am the only guy who actually felt that impact. Then I come back to what became, again, named Quiet Riot. And if you look at the back of the record, Mental Health is dedicated to his memory. I came back for that because I needed to celebrate Randy. And the best way that I could do it was to come home, get the joy back of me playing again with the people that I grew up playing with, that Randy was a part of that. Okay. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I had to move on because it became a toxic situation. But still, the whole thing lingered in me. Even though I started playing with Whitesnake and we were huge, it was kind of like, what would have happened if I would have stayed? It lingered in my mind, you know, if I had not left in 1985. So I had the opportunity to find the answer in 1997 when we reunited. And things are getting toxic again. And I said, you know what? I'm going to write this out because I need closure. I need an answer. So at that version of the band imploded, just like, you know, and I got the answer and I got the closure. But now that I'm back, and I came back in 2001 at the request of Frankie Benelli, for the first time, I feel like I have a higher purpose of me going on stage and playing the music that, along with everybody else, I recorded with, you know, for the Mental Health record and the Condition Critical record, which is the bulk of what we are, of our playlist, set list. And my responsibility is to celebrate the legacy of the band and the memory of Frankie Benelli and Kevin Dubrow and Randy Rhoads. If we don't do it, nobody else will. You know, and I'm talking honestly, an honest celebration and bringing joy back into the music. You know, so now I leave my house, like tomorrow I'm going to get out. I'll be out that door at 3:30 in the morning to head out to the airport. I'm on a mission. And I know exactly what it's going to be like on stage because I have a vision of what we do every single show.
And you're transmitting it. I just read a review of you at O2 just a couple of days ago, and they were saying how you just came out and you just killed it in the UK 2 days ago, and the passion that you brought on stage.
You know, but it was just. I mean, I love the different audiences, you know, and I really appreciate that people show up, you know, to hear us play. But I gotta tell you, see, each individual in the band, let's say Alex Grossi, our guitar player, has been in the band for over 20 years, and he was handpicked and groomed on All Things Quiet Riot by Kevin Dubrow. So then Frankie comes back and starts playing with Kevin, and they ask Alex to join this new version of Quiet Riot. And so Kevin passes away, and they bring in Jizzy Pearl, that was in a band called Love Hate, that, you know, Kevin loved that band, and he loved Jizzy's voice. And I know that because he would tell, he didn't like a whole lot of singers, but he really loved Jizzy. Okay. So Jizzy's perfect, and he's there. Frankie picked him. Alex brought him in. And then, you know, when Frankie got too sick to go on the road, you know, from taking chemo and other alternative remedies, you know, for cancer, Johnny Kelly, who was the drummer in Type O Negative, and Alex was doing some other projects with him, Alex brings him in. And then Frankie picks him and says, you know, see, Frankie never gave up on the idea of not ever playing drums again. So it wasn't until like the very end that Frankie asked him to be the drummer in the band. You know, so every person in that band, every member has been perfectly picked by the previous members who are no longer with us, Kevin and Frankie. You know, so all I had to do was come back and get reacquainted with who I am in Choir Raya, you know, be myself within the home that we all built, and just, you know, celebrate every single night, you know, and we do. I mean, to us, every show is magical. It is very magical. And sometimes certain odds are against us, you know, technical difficulties and things like that. Traveling, all the logistics involved, you know, from going to one city to another. And but once it's showtime, we put all that behind and we do it. We show up and we do it.
And the joy is in the music. The joy is back in the music for you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the joy is in the moment that you're actually, you know, you're... because, you know, it's like, you know, in the middle of the set, Jizzy gives me the microphone and I talk to the crowd and I introduce Thunderbird, which is the song that actually got me while I was still a member of Ozzy, and knowing that I needed to find the joy of making music again, was the song that Kevin called me up and say, hey, you know, how would you like to come to the studio to, and that started the whole thing rolling for me to come back to the band, you know? So it's a very special moment every single night for me.
It's beautiful.
Reconnecting with that, you know, it's like a loop. It's like a loop of a circle coming together, you know, just, you know, so it's, you have these moments that keep looping each other full circle.
Beautiful. Thank you so, so much, Rudy, for doing this. It's there's a zen spending time with you that I feel when I do. And it's so funny because you make what's called headbanging music, and you are the furthest thing from headbanging. You are head soothing and soul soothing and just a beautiful soul. Thank you so much for spending
Thank
this
you,
time.
Becky. Such a pleasure.
Enjoyed it as always. And I want to come out and see Quiet Riot. So are you guys playing in LA at all? Can we come
You know,
see you?
The next show we're doing, actually, it's the Ronnie James Dio Stand Up and Shout event. I believe it's May 16th. And it's going to be in Woodland Hills.
Oh, God, I'm in Italy in May. Shit.
Oh. Well, you're going to be in Italy, so that's
well,
not too bad.
That's true.
We'll be back. We'll be back after that. Okay. There's going to be some shows are scheduled. We usually play twice. Oh, yeah. We've usually played two or three times in the area, but, you know, especially this, the Hollywood, and we're going to be in Woodland Hills, which is, you know, not that far away, you know, from Hollywood.
Well, so, I'll stay in touch, and you'll let me know the next time I have an opportunity. And
you got
thank you so much, Rudy. I really
thank
appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
It's been wonderful
God bless
to
you.
Spend time with you. Bye-bye.
You too. God bless you. Bye-bye.